just kind of looking back at 15 and 16 last week, the seven, you know, the seven thunders, I think, is very interesting. And I'm trying to find where that is located. I believe it's in 15. Or maybe it's, anybody remember? 10:4. Well, I'm way off if that's it. Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Yep. Another week that I was gone from. I think this cycle, the reason I wanted to bring that up is because I think the sequences of seven are interesting in that you have seals, which is very generic, just an unveiling of God's plan. And then you have trumpets, which is a very symbolic way of talking about a warning or a judgment of some kind. And then you have bowls, the bowls of wrath, that the images of them completely being poured out, whereas the seals afflicted a quarter of, the trumpets afflicted one-third of. By the time we get to the bowls of God's wrath, it affects all. And, you know, if you're tracking kind of the role or the location of the people of God, one of the challenges that interpreters have wrestled with is the people of God are not ever designed to be the objects of God's wrath. And so when we have God pouring out the bowls of his wrath in its entirety, afflicting the entirety of the earth, then we have a problem. What, you know, are followers of Jesus still considered, or are they still here? Are they affected by that? Or are we pushing the all perhaps a little bit too much? Maybe it just refers to all of the nations that stand against God. I say all that to say the seven thunders is interesting because a thunder kind of serves the same role as a trumpet, doesn't it? I mean, it's a rumble, it's a warning of storms that are coming. And while we don't know what they are, to me it seems like an interesting way of God to say there's a time and place whenever the warnings cease and the judgments begin. A lot of the things that take place, whether we think of natural disasters, evil in the world, you know, God's hand at work in discipline or punishment, even when we can't identify those things, for us, when something bad happens, it's universal to the human race. We all lose people. We all get sick. We all, we all have to deal with trials and difficulties. And sometimes it may be God's judgment. Sometimes it may be just the consequences of our own bad decisions. Sometimes it may be that we get wrapped up in the consequences of somebody else's bad decisions, and we have to share in something we didn't even do. But the universal quality to all of those is all of those things are designed to remind us this world is not our home. This world is perishing. We are seeking for a world where all of those things, loss and grief and pain and suffering and death, do not exist. And so all those things are designed to draw us near to God. What you find in Revelation is that for some people it does draw them near to God, but for many people it causes them to get angry with God and to push away from him. And I think you see that very prevalently in our world today. When something bad happens in someone's life, sometimes even within the church, they use that as an excuse to get angry with God and rebel against him or push him away, instead of seeing that as an opportunity for them to draw near to him. And so, whether it's trumpets, whether it's thunders, whether it's seals, there are warnings, warnings, warnings all throughout our life calling us to respond to God. But the time will come for warnings to end and judgments to begin. And so that is kind of the flow of these cycles of seven as they appear in Revelation. The seven bowls were included in last week's text. And as we begin chapter 17, it says, "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come and I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters.'" If you look at the first part of the notes, these two chapters, 17 and 18, really are a package deal, so it's good that we're doing them together. They're viewed together as the collective fall of Rome. Rome is the historical enemy in the context of Revelation. But Rome is also very much a type, an archetype, or in biblical literature, we just call it a type of similar entities that will exist throughout the history of the church. And so it's not necessarily only Rome, but it's definitely Rome. It's Rome plus. And of course, plus also includes whatever the ultimate example will be. And so I use the phrase the spiritual Babylon just because when we talk about the people of God in Revelation, we refer to them as the spiritual Israel, recognizing that that's not always ethnic Israel. It's anybody who has been grafted into the branch of Israel from a spiritual point of view that is the people of God, the covenant people of God. And so spiritual Babylon is nations or kings or people that from a spiritual point of view follow in the line of Rome in opposition, in violence, in hatred of God, in persecution of God's people. So these two chapters are going to talk about the fall of Rome. You see, it is the manifestation of the seventh bowl poured out against the harlot. And I was looking in here. The seventh bowl is verse 17 in the previous chapter. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air, and out of the temple came a loud voice from the throne saying, "It is done." Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. Verse 19, the great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. And so a lot of interpreters will take 17 and 18 and say, this is kind of like we've zoomed in here on the seventh bowl to see exactly what this judgment on Babylon or fall of Rome looks like. So let's keep reading. The prostitute sits on many waters. Later on, if you look down at verse 15, it'll tell us the waters are the nations, people, multitudes. And so the harlot is whoever that is, whether it's a king or an emperor or a nation that has authority over a multitude of people, government, rulers, dictators. With her, it says, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Can you think of historic examples? Not just Rome, but in the history of humanity over the last 2,000 years that fits this example. The symbolic prostitute that makes the kings of the earth come and join with her, that makes other people rally and become intoxicated by her perspective or her racism or her oppression. There should be lots of examples. Yeah, I think the Nazi regime in Germany is a good example. There were periods within the Catholic Church that sounded very much like this. Yeah. You know, I don't know how you are with Eastern history. You know, how you are with Ottoman Empire, how you are with Mongol hordes, how you are with, you know, French Revolution, you know, how you are with, I mean, you could be pushing the envelope a little bit, Revolutionary War here in the U.S. I mean, wars are fought over stuff like this all the time, and the Nazi Empire is easier for us because it's closer in history to us, but it's easy to see how one figure can kind of rally all the political leaders around his own country and even kind of graft in political leaders from other countries and even people who are professing to be followers of Jesus can kind of get swept up in, you know, this ideology that is oppressive and violent and unjust. You know, I think there are types of this scenario. Obviously, in John's context, it's Rome, but we see this scene played out over and over and over again throughout human history. And the message here of Revelation is in part that those empires always rise and fall. You know, the book the rise and fall of the Roman Empire speaks specifically to that, but Nazi Empire as well. I mean, it wreaked havoc and caused all kinds of trouble and problems in a world war, but its time was limited. A lot of what you see in these two chapters is, and we see this even in philosophy of storytelling, in narrative, in writing, in screenplays, that the elements that lead to the downfall of oppressive governments and oppressive people are inherent within their qualities. It's why you watch a bad guy versus good guy movie, and the bad guy just continues to do things in such a way that enables them to be caught. Why doesn't the Joker ever just kill Batman? Why does he put him in some elaborate trap that Batman can escape from with something from his utility belt in the old show, right? Why doesn't he just kill him? And while that doesn't make a lot of sense, it does from a philosophical point of view, it does, in that the ego and hubris of evil and wickedness leads to its own downfall. It's set up that way. Verse 3, the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert, and there I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman, we presume, is the prostitute already spoken of. The scarlet beast, it's reminiscent of the dragon, which we identify with Satan, but we're also going to see, well, it's going to identify these heads and horns with the Roman Empire. If we keep reading, it says, the woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She had a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. And this title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Stop right there. John is describing the woman in detail. And to me, when I read this, I think of the scarlet beast as more this continuous entity, whether it's Satan, whether it's the principle of evil, the worldly system of evil, the scarlet beast rides on across the history of humanity. The woman is the individual icons. It could be Hitler, it could be, Genghis Khan, could be, take your pick. It changes, but in those cases, it's usually seizing power for the purpose of personal authority, and in a lot of cases you see here, wealth. Wealth in these two chapters you're going to see drives a lot of Rome's push for conquest, for persecution. And so the woman is portrayed dressed very elaborately with jewels, drinking from a very fancy goblet, and all of this is propped up by her persecution and execution of the saints of Jesus. So clearly, again, this is obviously Rome. It's just not only Rome. Then, verse 7, the angel said to me, why are you astonished? Why would John be astonished at seeing this? We're in chapter 17. He's seen a lot of peculiar things. Why now? And while I don't have the answer, yeah, Larry. Larry has the answer. Exactly the comment. The comment that I read this week was someone said, after all of the seals and the trumpets and the bowls, that she would still be there. Just a sense of amazement that this is still going on. So exactly, Larry did have the answer, at least as good an answer as I've got. It moves to the dragon, or the beast, we should say. The angel said to me, why are you so astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides. I love it in apocalyptic literature when they say, we will explain to you the mystery, and then we're left just as perplexed as we were before. Seven heads and ten beasts. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction. What do you think of that descriptor? Once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and to go to his destruction. Again, remember how at several points along the way where Satan masquerades as an agent of light. We had one of the beasts that says, look like a lamb, but spoke like a dragon. How God marks his people, his followers, with his name. Remember how many times, even in the first seven letters, it says, and they will be given a new name, or they will know the name of God. And how at several places up to this point, we had the mark of the beast, and even the blasphemous names written on this scarlet dragon that Satan tries to mimic God in a lot of ways, or at least that's how John portrays it. So, does that sound at all in that chain of thought? What does Revelation have to say about God that is similar to this sentiment that the beast once was, now is not, and will come up to go to its destruction? Yeah, do y'all see that? What is this? What's the refrain about God throughout Revelation? The one who was, the one who is, and the one who is to come. Yeah, it's another formulaic way of communicating here with some obvious significant differences. Once was, now is not, and will come up again to go into the abyss. There are those, you know, when we get to the millennium in a week or two, and the binding of Satan for 1,000 years for the kingdom of God to move, there are those who would say, we are living in that day now, that the millennium is now. Now, this position has its benefits, but also has its flaws. But what they would say is that Satan is bound currently, that he once was, he now is not, and he will come up out of the abyss again to go to his destruction. Not that there's not evil and wickedness in the world today, but that it's evil and wickedness perpetuated by humanity or by the beasts that carry the dragon's influence forward. Again, I'm not telling you this is my perspective. The perspective would say that the church is free to carry forth its mission without war being made specifically against it by the dragon himself. Maybe the dragon's agents are free, but the kingdom of God is advancing, spreading, the church is growing. Again, there's a part of me that likes that sentiment. It feels like it makes sense, but there's a part of me that's not completely convinced. So, and you'll see when we get to the millennium too, this reign, the millennium speaks about a reign, that the people of God will reign on the earth. And while the church is working and the kingdom of God is growing, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that we reign on the earth currently. But that sentiment about the dragon, that certainly gives us pause. What does it mean when it says he once was but now is not? Limited in some capacity, perhaps? The victory of Christ on the cross surely amounts to something in Satan's ability to influence what's going on in the world. Like I said, the angel says, oh, I'll explain the mysteries to you. And then he says stuff like this, and we don't have any further really. Now we need explanation of the explanation. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, It does, and the story of the Catholic Church is written large with those kinds of cycles, in large part, again, because their history is 1,400 years more than any of the rest of our denominations. But even in modern days, even in Baptist life, you can see sometimes power-hungry leaders, authoritarian-style, you know, leadership. And it's, listen, if you think in church leadership, the same way you think in political leadership, it's what American democracy is supposed to provide that a monarchy does not. If you have dictator-style leadership, when it's good, it can be really, really good. But when it's bad, it can be really, really, really bad. And the whole system of checks and balances is supposed to keep it from ever really getting really, really bad. The people govern. And so the Catholic Church is to monarchy what the Baptist Church is to democracy. You know, whenever they have good popes, the Catholic Church and their leadership is really, really, can be really, really good. But when they've been in history, when they've been corrupt, look out. I mean, it's been terrible. You know, the Baptists and leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention and other leaderships, there have been those that have pushed for more control and more authority. But there's kind of a system of checks and balances that heretofore has kept that kind of reined in a little bit. Now, we'll see if that lasts forever. It may not, but that may be more church politics than you guys bargained for tonight. So, anyways, the beast which you saw, verse 8, once was, now is not, and will come out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. Seven hills, of course, being the seven hills of Rome, the city built on seven hills. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. All right. So, five kings, a sixth king, a seventh king, and an eighth king. The eighth king seems to be this beast that was and now is not and is to come. And so, if you will, perhaps we have seven leaders, oppressive leaders, all of a human variety, to be followed by an eighth that may be a bit more of a supernatural variety. Does that make sense? The eighth one represents more strongly the beast itself. If you're looking for an ultimate antichrist, the perfect example to encapsulate all of the other antichrists that operate throughout history, perhaps this is a place to locate him or her. I hate to call him a him. What if we totally missed that? We call it. Are these kings in Rome, emperors of Rome, that persecute the early church? Quite possibly. The interesting thing is we have 5 plus 2 plus 1 here. And if you keep going, verse 12, it says, the 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. The other possibility, and there are writers who've tried to identify in these seven kings, figures like, I mean, we use Hitler because he's just a good example, figures like that that have cropped up throughout the church age. And perhaps we have these, you know, these characters that will culminate in the Antichrist at the end. And the ten kings that have not yet been given authority are governmental rulers, business leaders, influential leaders that will gather around that Antichrist at the end. For a lot of Revelation, I've really pushed us to think about Roman context and history of the church. Roman context and history of the church. These are messages that, yes, they play on into the future, but they're also taking place now. As we get closer to the end of Revelation, we're going to find more and more things that really seem to only have a future context. And this eighth king that is the beast that will gather ten other kings around it. I mean, we could work really, and preterists, by the way, will isolate all of this in the Roman Empire. That they'll come up with emperors before John, emperors after John writes, leading up to the fall of Rome. And they would say that ultimately what we're dealing with here in Revelation is the fall of the Roman Empire. I tend to think that even if that is the case, it's still just a type of the grander spiritual Babylon, and war between God and spiritual Babylon. But it seems like we're pushing into the domain of more futuristic events at this point. Let's finish the chapter and I'll see if you guys have any questions that I can answer. The angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages." By the way, usually whenever Revelation is describing the earth, it does so in some kind of fourfold refrain. Remember, we've talked about how the number four is symbolic of creation. And here you see it again. The waters are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. It's a fourfold description of the earth. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. The great city. Babylon. Rome. What other city? The very bottom of the notes on page one, of the first side, the three major components of the fall of Rome you see here. External invasion. The Lamb, the followers of the Lamb. The beast has given certain ones power to come and destroy the harlot. Internal rebellion. Spiritual decay. You kind of see those wrapped up in that last summary and throughout the chapter. But again, the components of the fall are wrapped up within the nature of the harlot, the nature of the prostitute. And her character leads to her own destruction. So, if you go back to the top, I mention here that little bullet point. Chapter 17 reads like a religious and political downfall. Where we're going, chapter 18 is going to read more like a commercial and economic downfall. So it's almost like they're telling the same story, they're just telling it from two different angles. This here in chapter 17 from a religious political angle, and then the next one from an economic commercial angle. It'd be really easy to kind of nitpick here. Pick out details. What does it mean by this word? What does it mean by this description? What's the, you know, who's the sixth king? Who's the seventh king? I think the bigger question is if you just kind of pull back and look at big picture, the harlot that sits atop the scarlet beast, the harlot that drinks the blood of the saints and martyrs of Christ, that ultimately will lead to its own destruction, but reigns for a period, sits atop the beast for a period. Does this kind of communicate? Can you see it? In the imagery of John, can you see it played out in history? And that's the question. So questions or thoughts or comments on 17? As Revelation gets closer to the end, I have a harder time with it. I'm very comfortable with chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the part we preached on, interpretation, seeing it in the modern context, the seven seals, pretty comfortable with that, seven trumpets, yeah. But as we kind of creep further in, closer here towards the end, some of this imagery really gets tough. Grasping it, interpreting it is harder for me. So maybe that's on purpose as we're starting to deal more and more with future stuff we haven't experienced or seen yet, as opposed to things going on in our world that we do see. But I think examples of this harlot on the scarlet beast, we can identify some of those that are kind of like Rome. Of course, the challenge with Rome is it lasted for centuries. Nazi Germany lasted for less than a decade, right? Maybe a couple, yeah. But certainly not centuries like Rome. Yeah, Charles? There have been lots of attempts to try and identify those 10 kings. What are the 10 kings that surround the Antichrist? Who are they going to be? And why the European nations, European Union? It's the easy identifier of the day. So, I mean, who's to say it's not 10 states in the United States or, you know, 10, I don't know. You know, the way the world is moving, I mean, while it's still run by governments, the ultra-rich, the billionaires of the world, seem to exercise more and more and more and more influence over what things happen. And it may not even be kings and presidents and rulers so much as it might be magnates, hedge fund managers, you know, the world's uber wealthy. Who's to say? Who's to say? Could be like Spectre on James Bond, with the Antichrist at one end of the table and the 10 kings all sitting around the long boardroom. Or Dr. Evil on Austin Powers. Chapter 18. A little more poetic here. It's interesting because we're used to reading Revelation and it's all... We talk about Revelation as being apocalyptic literature, and yet it really is diverse in genre. We've had visions, we've had letters, and now we get a song. I mean, in the Bible, we would call this literature psalms. It's not a very poetic or beautiful psalm. I don't know that, you know, our choir and orchestra, John, are going to be composing a hymn around Revelation 18, but that is the genre we're working with here. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird, for all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." Verse 3, three more reasons for the fall of Rome. Seduction reached the furthest limits. Kings of the earth committed acts of immorality. Merchants of the earth have become wealthy. Reasons for the fall moves to reasons why people should distance themselves. I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, and so that you will not receive any of her plagues." Come out of her, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes. Maybe rapture here. That almost sounds, That sounds more like rapture language than back in chapter 4, where John is told to come up here. But my sentiment or my feeling here is this is a little bit more of that we are called to make a choice to separate ourselves from the principalities that Paul prays against, the systems of the world that lead to oppression and poverty and et cetera, et cetera. You know, we try and do things like this here where we can. Part of it is our own understanding. Part of it is our own capacity to do this. Human trafficking is a big conversation, and in large part in the Christian church in America today, as it specifically pertains to sex trafficking. But our pastor of serving ministries, Aaron Glenn, is careful to remind us that probably 80 to 90% of trafficking in the world is not sex trafficking, it's labor trafficking. And in a lot of cases, American consumers contribute to it unknowingly. We want to be able to pay 99 cents for a cup of coffee, or we want to be able to buy chocolate bars, the two most labor trafficking connected commodities in the world, coffee and chocolate. We want to be able to pay 99 cents for a cup of coffee, not realizing that that's keeping somebody somewhere working on a salary of about $3 or $4 a day. Or we're buying coffee from a company that's doing that, that's trafficking in labor from people around the world. And so that's why you see, you know, little coffee and signs in our serving area. Fair trade is such an important language in chocolate and coffee. And can we do that completely and fully with our system here? Maybe not so much, but there are things we can raise awareness and raise understanding. You know, that's a sentiment here is whenever you learn, whenever you see this kind of oppressive system of government that's keeping people down, take action. You're the people of God. Come out of that in as much as you're able. And so we spend a lot of money on coffee up here every year. And if we can give all that money to a company that is in large part trafficking in labor around the world, or we can give all that money to companies that are helping small farmers in impoverished third world countries make a sustainable living and provide for their families and support their communities, which one is the right course of action for us to take? It's a pretty easy decision. But a lot of that is awareness. It's education. And it's making small decisions, little things like that. For me, it's not complaining, and I don't know. I think Starbucks is fair trade in a lot of cases. I'm not positive. I don't like having to pay $2.11 for a cup of coffee that I could go somewhere else and pay 99 cents or 50 cents for. But in the grand scheme of things, that may be the difference in supporting fair trade farmers as opposed to supporting trafficked farmers under a corporation that takes advantage of them. So I don't know a whole lot about all this. I'm in the process of learning myself. But that's, you know, whenever I don't think when it says Babylon the Great, my people come out of her, I don't think that's rapture language so much as it is for us, even living within our country that is free and productive and beautiful and great, there are still systems of oppression that take advantage of the poor, that take advantage of a lot of people inherent within our country, and we need to be fighting those. There have been a group of pastors in our city that fought against payday lending and that practice within our country because they felt like it needlessly took advantage of poor people. They borrow money from paychecks and then they would charge them at an exorbitantly high interest rate that they can never end up paying it back. You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, I don't. Yeah, and I don't know a whole lot. So what I do is, you know, I'm not going and looking for that information. But when I'm made aware of it, you know, I do what I can to act responsibly in that regard. So, you know, ask Aaron. He's the resident expert on trafficking around the world. He would say, yeah. Yeah. A lot of trafficking is in the textile industry, you know. And you'll see a lot of stuff about Nike, you know, that Nike takes their, you know, their warehouses over to Indonesia and Malaysia and places, and, you know, they're paying kids, you know, pennies on the dollar for what they should be making in order to have their shoes made, and then bring them over here and sell them at ridiculously high costs. My kids buy Nike shoes. So, I mean, it's why we're so grateful and appreciative that our salvation is by faith and not by works. But as people of God, we want to be educating ourselves. And, you know, it's also a matter of personal conviction, too, in ways. But I use those not to soapbox, but to give an example here, I think, of what he's saying. When you see things that are typical of the world, don't go along with them. Back to Nazi Germany, how many Christians and how many churches just got in line behind the Nazi philosophy and went along with it and gave no consideration to the fact that it was against the nature and character of Christ that they were doing, what they were doing. And then you had characters like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's the figurehead, but lots and lots of others just like him that were in the Christian church and said, no, we're not going to, even if it costs us prison or our life here in our own country, we're not going to be a part of the harlot's march forward. We're going to come out and we're going to stand for what is right. Verse 6, give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, I sit as queen. I am not a widow, and I will never mourn. Therefore, in one day, her plagues will overtake her, death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. Lots of lists in this, if you really read carefully. You know, two reasons to get away from the harlot, three retributive elements. Whatever she does, she will receive back in kind. It will be delivered in proportion to her sin. It will be a double portion or double punishment. Three plagues associated with that punishment: pestilence, mourning, and famine. And then moving forward, we jump to verse 19 and 20 before we get to the merchants. It says, these are the three people that lament her downfall. When the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In one hour, your doom has come. Notice how quick it happens. Soon, in one hour. The kings lament, the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of, and list them, gold, silver, stones, pearls, fine linen, purple silk, and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood, articles of every kind of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cargoes of cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, of wine, olive oil, flour, wheat, cattle and sheep, horses, carriages, and bodies and souls of men. Slaves, in other words. And notice that they come last. It's not as easy to count them off, but in the Greek text, it's 28 items. The luxurious items of the world, there are 28 of them. Seven are number of completion or perfection, times four, a number representing the earth. It's counted out very specifically to kind of give a holistic picture, but it's all of these are items of affluence, items of wealth. And the merchants weep because their source of wealth has passed them by. They will say, the fruit you long for is gone. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, woe, woe, O great city. Dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. It's described just like the harlot in chapter 17. In one hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. And thirdly, every sea captain and all who travel by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea, will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this, great city? They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she has been brought to ruin. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. You have three that weep and wail over the fall of Babylon. You see them here, the kings, the merchants, and the sailors. And in every case, all three of those mourn why? Babylon was a source of their power and their wealth. They gained off of the oppressive nature and unjust qualities of the harlot, Babylon, Rome. Listen, when you hear all of the language about wealth and luxury and affluence, a lot of times Christians in America like to read Revelation, and we always look outwardly for all the enemies of God, and we always look inwardly for all the good characteristics in Revelation. But it should cause us to pause when we see the harlot identified with all this amount of wealth and realize that we live in the wealthiest country in the world. Should give us pause. Now, I have friends that work in other parts of the world, and they'll tell you the gap between rich and poor is different around the world, and the wealth of the wealthy in other parts of the world is a different level than what you have here. Wealth is seems to be more evenly distributed in our country than it is in a lot of other places. So there's always a little come and go argument. You know, you could pound on America. You could say, you know, here's where we're bad. You could come back and say, yeah, but here's where we're good. Here's where we're, you know, better than some other places. It's not a sentiment. We're talking about spiritual forces here, much more so, I think, than we're talking about worldly kingdoms, boundaries, things like that. But to think that the spiritual influence of the harlot and the dragon are not present here in our own country, but are present in every other country in the world, would be foolish on our part. In the sense that the people of God is represented by every tribe and people and tongue and nation, those that follow the harlot are represented from every tribe and people and language and nation. Spiritual entities, for those that have eyes to see. But you see there the 28 items, five results of the fall, and observations of the fall of Babylon. It's worth noting that while the kings and the merchants and the sailors all mourn, you do have in verse 20 this rejoicing that takes place. There are many who lament the fall of Babylon, but there are some who rejoice. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. Vindication of the people of God. And then the chapter wraps up. A mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again." This is that list, the five results of the fall of Babylon. No workman of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone never heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In her was found the blood of prophets and of the saints and of all who have been killed on the earth. And so you see the observations that this fall happens suddenly. It ultimately will be a permanent destruction. For many, it's an occasion of lament. But for some, those specifically that are followers of the Lamb, it is a cause for rejoicing. 17 and 18. Somewhat imprecise. We go Rome, and then we go Babylon. Which is which? Well, they kind of seem to be one and the same, we think. But you have to really read through a spiritual lens in order to see that. And that can be challenging at times. But remember, if we go back to the dragon and the beasts, it says this is how the dragon makes his war against the people of God, was through the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. Governmental, oppressive governmental powers that are fueled and supported by false religious beliefs. And now here we have the two biggest examples in John's world, Babylon from the Old Testament, Rome from the New Testament. And it says, look, yes, Satan sends his beasts out, and yes, they kill the saints. They win victories. People pay prices. They make sacrifices. But ultimately, their time is short. Their destruction is coming. It has come, and it is coming. These entities once were, maybe now they're not, but they're coming again. This is the way of things, building and building until the end. And so, I tell you, the challenge I have, a lot of Revelation I read as simultaneously being past, present, and future. And that template doesn't automatically work on everything in here, but it works on a lot of things in here. There are some things that are clearly only future. The ultimate final judgment, you know, the ultimate reign, obviously that's future. But a lot of things, the seven letters, past, present, future. The seven seals, past, present, future. We get here to this, and I try to do the same with Rome the harlot and Babylon the great. You see them as past. Can you see them as present? Can you see them written throughout, not just Rome and Babylon, but the history of humanity? Can you see them in existence in the world today? And do you believe that they're going to continue, maybe in increasing measure, until the final judgment ultimately happens? It's tough to do, but I think that's a good exercise to practice. Yes? Yeah. Just in my own lifetime, I remember being a kid and a couple of guys from our town going to, I think it was Kuwait, maybe. Desert Storm. Was Desert Storm in Kuwait? Or was it in Iraq? Yeah. You know, and that easily transitioned into, you know, Saddam Hussein. And he was the great big scary monster in world history, at least for us as Americans, based on what our media had to say. And he came and went, you know. And then we had Osama bin Laden, and he came and went. And as soon as one disappears, then we have whoever's the dictator of North Korea, you know, is now one. And, you know, we go from Stalin in Russia to, before Stalin. Lenin was earlier, then Stalin. You know, in Russia, yeah, and Mussolini and Hitler and, you know, I mean, who knows what's going on in the whole U.S.-Russian dialogue and interaction today. But yeah, one goes away and another comes. You know, it's almost like, you know, the dragon, you cut the head off and it grows, another one grows back. This is the way it's going to be. It's the way of things. And we should not like it. It's a spiritual war that we're a part of, but we shouldn't be surprised. You know, we shouldn't be surprised. We move from Vietnam to Korea to, you know, and now all of a sudden things in Vietnam are a little bit better, but things in Korea are not. And, you know, you've got the drug cartels in Colombia are not as big a deal. You know, that's not quite as bad, but Venezuela is bankrupt and, you know, on the border of anarchy. And, you know, I mean, it might have been Kuwait for a while and Iraq for a while, and now it's Syria. I mean, if it's not one, it's another. It's just, it's a perpetual cycle that's going to keep going. And that's why ultimately, in order for this cycle to end, the Lamb has to come back. It's the only thing that will make it end.